The House will come to order. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 133. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 12, dispensing rooms, products sold. Ayes 28, noes 1, conflict 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 134. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 13, Mental Health Professions Practice Act Amendments. Ayes 28, noes 2, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 135. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 18, Business Entities Revisions. Ayes 30, no 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 136. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 19, Clandestine Drug Laboratories Remediation. Ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 137. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 24, Health Insurance Clinical Trials. Ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 138. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 27, County Nuisance Abatement Authority. Ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 139. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 28, Investment of State Funds. Ayes 30, noes 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 140. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 29, Public Library Endowment Challenge Program. Ayes 29, noes 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 141. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 31, Domestic Violence Counseling Period. Ayes 30, no 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 142. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 36, Public Health Emergencies Volunteers. Ayes 30, no 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 143. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 38, People First Language. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 144. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 40, Uniform Trust Code Amendments. Ayes 27, noes 2, conflict 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 145. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 41, Vacating Subdivisions. Ayes 28, noes 2. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 146. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 42, Wyoming Court Security Act. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 147. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 54, School Finance Rebated Recapture. Ayes 25, noes 5. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 148. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 56, Omnibus Water Bill Construction. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 149. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 58, State Trust Land Management Account. Ayes 28, noes 2, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 150. Mr. Speaker, the bills as below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 62, Emergency Medical Technicians. Ayes 28, noes 1, conflict 1, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 151. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 65, Post-Conviction Relief Petitions, DNA Evidence. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 152. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 66, Community Juvenile Services. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 153. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 71, Hathaway Scholarship Program Success Curriculum. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 154. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 76, Private Roads. Ayes 28, noes 2. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 155. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 81, Fire Protection Districts, New Entities. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 156. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 83, Retirement Rehired Retirees. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 157. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 84, Fireman's Pension Account Amendments. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 158. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 85, Health Care Reform Pilot Project. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 159. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 87, Capitol Building Restoration. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 160. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in by the vote indicated. Senate File 88, Inmate Medical Furlough. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 161. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File number 5, Peace Officers, Probation and Parole Agents. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 162. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 26, Business Entities Registered Agents. Ayes 19, noes 11. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 163. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below failed to pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 46, Discharged Water Management. Ayes 15, noes 15. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 51 engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brown, Childers, Kraft, Davison, Goggles, Yagi, Slater, Thompson, excused, Eichel, signed Representative Childers, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 55 engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Berger, Jones, Jorgensen, Peterson, Philp, Warren, excused, Harshman, signed, Representative Philp, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House resolve itself into the Committee of the Whole.
You have heard the motion. All of those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Representative Gingrey.
The Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 2. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 2, introduced by Senator Burns, an act relating to the Select Committee on Natural Resources Funding. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which returned it with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Childers, Kraft, Davison, Goggles, Yagi, Slater, Thompson, excused, Eichel, sign represented Childers, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Childers?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that bill number Senate File 2 do pass, and I'll turn the bill over to the good representative from House District 50 to explain the bill. And with that, folks, here I am. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring Senate File 2, Select Natural Resource Funding Committee Chairmanship. This bill is a simple bill. It basically changes from a chair to vice chair to two members to serve as co-chair. Quite frankly, with six members on the committee, it's difficult to come up with an agreement to have a chair. So both the good senator on the other end and I agreed to bring this bill, and that's basically it. It just there's six members on the committee, and two members will serve as co-chairman. If there's no questions, I'll call for the question.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Childers' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 2 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. Senate File 2 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 3. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 3, introduced by the Travel Committee, an act relating to game and fish funding. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom was which returned it with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Childers, Kraft, Davison, Goggles, Yagi, Slater, Thompson, excused, Eichel.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Childers?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 3 do pass. And there are no standing committee amendments, and I'll explain the bill. Ladies and gentlemen, Senate File 3, game and fish funding, is basically what we've been considering for several years, except the bill does not have an appropriation in it. Basically, what we have decided to do in the committee and both the interim committee and the Senate has agreed at this point that the Game and Fish Department, when they study sensitive and non-game species, they will go through the budget process just like any other agency. So sensitive and non-game species, instead of coming from the from your hunting fees, hunting and fishing fees, it will be coming through the budget process. And even though this bill has not passed as yet, as you've noticed during the budget process, we have discussed this in detail. And currently, approved on the House side. We have, under the Comprehensive Wildlife Conservation Strategy, as amended, we have a little over $1.8 million in the budget. And if you'll go to page 3 of the bill, all that goes into detail about how the commission shall prepare a separate budget, maintain it, that budget separate from their normal budget, and include in the annual accounting a report on it. And that's basically what the bill does. If there are no questions, I'll...
I just sneak in here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Representative Korbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, is this a commitment then? Are we now making a commitment by putting this in statute that we are going to pay for all sensitive species and non-game through our general fund?
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, all it guarantees is that the Game and Fish will submit a budget requesting monies for that, and it's up to the budget process to decide whether they get funds for that. And currently, through the budget process, they've allowed $1.8 million on this end, and I think the other end has a similar amount. No guarantee in the future, but all it does is simply say that the Game and Fish Department will or shall go through the budget process in the future for sensitive and non-game species. It won't come out of the hunting and fishing fees.
Representative Dockstader.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps we could have some examples of what would qualify as a sensitive species and even in the non-game status. Thank you.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is a good step. My question really is this. Won't this give the legislature and all others a better handle on the monies that will be spent in this area than what we've had in the past?
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Chairman, without a doubt, it will give a much better handle. As far as the question about sensitive species, the definition for sensitive species, I think there's currently around 700 species on the list of species of concern. And basically what it amounts to is the, in consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service, from what I understand, it just basically species that they're concerned that there's a good possibility they could be listed. And the purpose is that we feel like that the Game and Fish Department will do whatever they can to make sure that the habitat and the species, everything is well known about it. And, you know, whatever happens in the listing process, the state of Wyoming is prepared to either counter any attempts to list a species, or hopefully before they are listed, we can do something to improve those the habitat for the species, or even improve the number of species to prevent them from being listed.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I read subparagraph D on page 3 and 4, I wonder, well, I see on page 4 that the commission shall prepare a separate accounting of the expenses incurred in each fiscal year for the operation and maintenance of programs funded through legislative appropriation. What we will have, if this bill passes, a separate budget for sensitive species and non-game programs that are currently funded through license fees. So we're shifting the burden of the sensitive species and non-game to the general fund budget. But what happens to those dollars that were being spent on sensitive species and non-game, that, and how do we understand how those funds are moved around or spent when the only accounting that we get is related to the legislative appropriation? Does the travel committee get enough information to understand fully where the license fees are going with regard to non-game and game species management?
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that the interim committee could vouch for what I'm about to say, that the budget coordinator for the Game and Fish Department gave us a very detailed analysis of what they do in their budget and how that particular section of the Game and Fish Department handles it. And I think most of us, if not all of us, feel very comfortable that that they will keep that separate from any of the expenditures they have or any of the funding that they have for the game species that comes under the hunting and fishing fees. And I do know that under current management that the Game and Fish Department will provide us any of the details that we need, and also will provide the legislature any of the details that they need of where those funds are going. That's the long answer. The short answer is yes. They'll cover it quite clearly.
Chairman Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if the good representative from House District 50 and the good chairman of Wildlife Committee would just give us, if we're talking 700 species, couldn't he give us about six names of these things? Are we talking about water snakes and rats, or what are we talking about here? Just give me half a dozen samples.
Chairman Childers.
Well, I think the good representative from 14, District 14 might have an answer for that, but Preble Jumping Mouse comes to mind. I think there's a little frog and a little, who knows? There's a lot of them. I've looked at the list, but I couldn't begin to tell you. Some of them are actually vegetation also.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, Game and Fish tells us there are about 800 species in the state of Wyoming. About 100 of those species we hunt, fish, or trap. That leaves about 700 species that we don't hunt, fish, or trap. We collect license fees for those species that we hunt, fish, or trap. And for a long time, through a number of species, for instance, the most notable probably being the black-footed ferret, they have borne the expense of dealing with the other 700 species out of license fees. And they have just simply gotten, and you've heard this plea from us before, but they have just simply gotten to the point where the license fee revenue won't carry it. For one thing, license fee revenue is decreasing. For another thing, more and more species are becoming sensitive, then they progress to threatened, then they finally progress to endangered. There are more and more of those species. And some people in the past have wanted to beat up on the Game and Fish and say, you're a bad guy because you're telling us about these endangered species or threatened species, like the sturgeon in the Powder River that's blind. I think there's three threatened species in the Powder River, one of which is the sturgeon. We've been through the pygmy rabbit, the plover, the black-footed ferret, prairie dogs now. Black-tailed prairie dogs is a big deal. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of what's coming. And so what we've tried to do through an educational process is say to people, we don't want you to beat up on the Game and Fish because they come and tell us about these. We need to monitor those, and we need to know when there are species in Wyoming that are getting in trouble. One that we do hunt, fish, or trap that's still getting in trouble that we've heard a lot from the Game and Fish about, and thankfully so, is the sage grouse. And so we don't want to kill the messenger, and if the Game and Fish didn't do this work for us, we'd have to create another state agency with parallel capabilities of the Game and Fish, mostly their wildlife biologists, just to do this work, because this is information that we need to have. So that's the purpose of this, as we say. I'm getting a signal back there that I can't decipher. Maybe he's saying me too. I'm not sure. So if you read this really carefully, it says the commission will prepare a separate budget requesting general funds to implement and maintain its sensitive species. And that is what we've called non-traditional funding. And that's what we've called supplemental funding that needs to come from the general fund, because game and fish outside of the 100 species that we hunt, fish, or trap has these other 700 that they're dealing with. I think we've clearly tasked them with monitoring those species, telling us when they're getting in trouble. I'm telling you, if these sage grouse get listed, we are in deep trouble. And you won't be able to do, I guess if you want to do anything in the state of Wyoming, you'll just phone Washington, D.C. and ask them if it's okay. Game and Fish is the agency that has to tell us about this. We want these funds in a separate budget so that we can identify and segregate those. We don't want them to revert back to the general fund. We want them to stay there. They report to the Travel, Recreation, and Wildlife and Cultural Resources Committee. We monitor that. As a result of this, they are now making a presentation to us of their entire budget, from soup to nuts. We've been through it. I've told you before, I'm really impressed with what their budget people are doing. And the purpose of this is to just get it in a separate fund and get some reporting about what they're doing with it. But believe me, it's something that we really need. We desperately need. So I would urge you to vote in favor of the bill.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I don't know how it is in some of your districts, but my sportsmen are getting tired of escalating license fees that are being used to pay for these non-game species that we have to control and find out what's happening to them so we can keep them off the list. We even had a bill, I believe it was last session, that had an automatic escalator clause on raising licenses for the game and fish in order to cover some of these costs. And I think at that session we decided that really wasn't fair. And I believe we asked the good travel commission to try and come up with some way that we could find a way to fund this out of the general fund. We could have some accountability. We'd know more about it. We'd know where it was going. And I think this bill does that. And I know that the sportsmen in my area are going to be very pleased with what's going on here. And we as legislators should be very pleased that we're getting some oversight and we'll gain some knowledge about what's going on and why it's going on. So on in support of the bill.
Representative Warren.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for the sponsors of the bill. During our JAC hearings, there was a significant request for general funds for sensitive species, and we had quite a debate about that, and there was a certain amount that we allocated. That exact number I don't have in front of me, but it was significant. It wasn't the full amount. There was no question that the support is needed, that the fees and current revenue is not adequate to meet the increased needs for monitoring species across the state for many reasons: drought, less hunting, mineral impact, and so on. The question about this bill that I would want to ask is, how come we have to legislate within a bill that this be a separate funding request? Question being, it was a separate funding request to the JAC committee, and I'm just wondering if this is a redundant request or if this is not already done at least well enough that we get feedback about the request and about the program. And so that I would ask why we'd need this in legislation, because it seems like we're already doing this. Thank you.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Much online with the good representative from Albany, I guess, as I read the fiscal note more closely, and I think the bill is fine. I guess my question is about the money, and as I read it, it talks, first of all, and I've heard a lot of testimony on the floor now about the endangered species and all the number of species and so on. I don't think any of us would disagree with that. But as I read the fiscal note more carefully, it talks about maintaining funding for the current folks who are employed, and then at the bottom it talks about the expansion. This program would be an expansion of the sage grouse program, for which there's currently a general fund standard budget. And just the numbers, I mean, we sage grouse planting and protection, $2.8 million for this biennium, and the comprehensive wildlife conservation strategy, this study, we actually on JEC added $650,000. The governor had $1.2 million in his budget, and we bumped it to $1.8 million. And then, of course, wolf management is another nearly $2.5 million, as well as the veterinary services program with brucellosis and so on. But so I'm wondering if this is kind of a double bump, the $605,000, if the expansion is necessary. And so I guess that's my question. I don't have a problem with the accounting of it separately, but why the expansion? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Goggles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill represents a shift in policy. That's basic. We're shifting the policy to the legislature to fund the activities regarding endangered species. And we're taking that shift from the sportsmen that have been paying this in the past. You can't continue to raise hunting and fishing licenses and expect a select group of folks to continue to fund that. That funding's got to come from here.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it may be difficult to understand that this bill's coming along and the budget's already done, but the two previous sessions, we brought a bill with money in it, and one of the big reasons that it failed, especially on the other end, is there's a question about the accountability. So what the interim committee did this last time is we would bring a bill without any funding in it, and as the good representative from the reservation has stated, this is a policy change. And the purpose of this bill is to lay it out quite clearly that sensitive and non-game species will be funded through the budget process. Now, maybe we were somewhat premature, or the Game and Fish Department was premature in sending their request in, but in discussions on the second floor, that was felt like that was the best way to do. We go ahead and introduce it into the budget process, but we want to make it quite clear in the legislature and in the statute that the sensitive and non-game species will be handled through the budgetary process, through general funds. And while on the fiscal note it does say it will expand the sagegrass program, I think all of those programs are laid out in detail in your budget bill in section 40 in the Game and Fish Commission, that the comprehensive wildlife conservation strategy, which is the sensitive non-game species, $1.8 million, and the sage-grouse program is funded currently at the $2.8 million, and as we've discussed in the bill concerning the wolves last time, that would be a separate issue too. And quite frankly, what we heard from the hunters in this state, hunters and fishermen, is they're tired of funding things that are non-game issues. Now, while admittedly the wolf and the grizzly bear will be hunted, currently we're carrying this through a different program. It's expensive. But we feel like this provides accountability, and this bill is just making the policy change to go ahead and do that. And what is in the current budget bill is quite clear what we are carrying for sensitive and non-game species and the other two programs or the other programs that we mentioned. I urge your passing of the bill.
Representative Davison.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman. I just want to remind you folks, I don't think this is premature at all. We've been suffering with these species for a long, long time. For many years, we've had to go and run out and take care of because someone said there was an endangered species. But just think about it. For all these years, Game and Fish hasn't asked for extra funding. They've been able to take care of themselves, and now they are. And it's because they have had this responsibility to step up to the plate and take care of these endangered species as they come up. So this is a shift in policy, but it's something we have to take care of. Thank you.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Chairman, two good examples of how this has worked. with the Preble's jumping mouse, there was an attempt to list that species. Through DNA analysis brought forth by the Game and Fish Department, it was determined that it's no more special than some of the other species found in other states. So we got out of listing that species. And the black-tailed prairie dog, while there has been an attempt to list that species, I think the Game and Fish Department made it quite clear that we don't know enough about the populations of that particular species. Allow the Game and Fish Department to investigate and see what that is. That's exactly what we're proposing to do in this bill. Through the general fund process, and the accountability is through the budget process. I'll call for the question on the bill.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Childers' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 3 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 3 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
The next bill for our consideration.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Chairman McComey.
May I have privilege of the floor?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, scattered around us is in the balcony is our bunch of FAA students on a trip here sponsored by the Farm Bureau's students to see government in action. And they are from various areas of the community and the state. From Cody, there's Kathleen Heltner. From Powell, there's Cian Alquist. From Lander, there's Riley Crescine and Cade Brewster. From Riverton, there's Colton George and Chance Woolery. From Wind River, there's Tim Wall and Sam Middlestadt. From Shoshone, there's Dustin Britton. From Thermopolis, there's Selena Stewart and Heather Love. If you'd stand and be acknowledged, we'd appreciate it. And, Mr. Chairman, they've been brought by the gentleman from my area that always is bringing them, and his wife, I believe, is here also, as well as some other sponsors. Mr. Dave Vaughn.
Representative Brown. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 4. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 4, introduced by the Corporation Committee, an act relating to foreclosure and redemption of realty sold under mortgage and execution. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Gilmore, Illaway, Martin, Meyer, Miller, Korberg, Stubson, Wanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole... I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 4 do pass. And I'd like the good representative from across the summit to discuss the bill.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill changes the acreage for agricultural real estate. Now, the significance of that is found in parts of 118-103 that are not part of the bill. Part A of that statute says that the redemption period for property is 3 months unless it's agricultural real estate. Part B says that if it's agricultural real estate, the redemption period is 12 months. So then that begs the question, what is agricultural real estate, which brings us to Part C. And Part C would change the acreage to define agricultural real estate from 20 acres to 80 acres. This has been requested by the bankers because they want to finance these properties and and then sell those mortgages on the secondary market. And the secondary market will not accept, like FHA, Fannie Mae, those. The secondary market will not accept mortgages on property that have this extended period of redemption. So they want to raise it from 20 acres to 80 acres, and then that raised the question, which we heard a lot about in committee, well, what if it's really agricultural property or it's being used as agricultural property? Then why wouldn't we wouldn't get the benefit anymore of the agricultural property redemption period of 12 months? And that's true. The origin, I believe, of the 12-month period for agricultural property to be redeemed is so that no matter what time of the year the foreclosure took place, it would get one through the balance of the agricultural cycle on that property before they had before they lost their right of redemption. And I think the answer to that concern, which we heard that concern several times, is found in the part of the bill on page 2, its existing language, that begins on line 1 and page 2 and says, if the mortgage recites that the real estate involved is agricultural real estate, it's presumed by the parties to the mortgage, blah, 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 that everyone's agreed to to be bound by the provisions of law relative to the right of redemption. So if it's less than 80 acres and it is being used as agricultural real estate and the mortgagor, wants the benefit of the 12-month period of redemption, then he and his banker simply need to agree and state in the mortgage, right in the face of the mortgage, this is agricultural real estate. And that is code language that says we are agreeing that in the event there's a foreclosure, there will be a 12-month period of redemption instead of a 3-month period of redemption. So, in short, Mr. Chairman, it changes the 20 acres to 80 acres for the 12-month redemption, except for the property that might be involved in that that's still being used agriculturally. It still preserves a way that the mortgagor and the mortgagee can agree that the redemption period is going to be 12 months instead of 3 months. So with that, I'd stand for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question on page 2 of the bill, and I'm wondering if presumed is the best language that we can use, where it says it is presumed to the parties to the mortgage, because presumptions are rebuttable. And I'm wondering if we should say it either is or it isn't, but it might be just for certainty of title issues.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I'm confused by the explanation of the last part of the bill on page 2. When I look at lines 5 and 6 on page 2, I see that it says, have agreed to and are bound by all the provisions of law relative to the right of redemption. If we change the law relative to the right of redemption is anything under 80 acres does not get the agricultural exemption, regardless of what the mortgage might say. That's the way I read that language. And I still, just because the banks may want to sell these loans on the secondary market, is that a reason to change the agricultural exemption under the right of redemption? I understand in the mortgage industry, it is difficult to sell something on the secondary market if it's got that right of redemption, but the other alternative is to keep that loan in-house so you don't have to sell that loan. And I just wonder, is this the best way to approach the issue? And I guess if you could answer that first question first, is my reading of the language wrong?
Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions. One is whether or not we have a good fix on how many parcels we're looking at, how many people we're looking at affecting by this change. And two, in C, page 1, we talk about a new definition for what we're going to call agricultural real estate, increasing the acreage to 80. And I'm wondering how that comports with other definitions of agricultural real estate. Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I guess I would plead with everyone that everything on page 2 is existing language. And so we're not making any changes on page 2. As far as saying that it's presumed, the presumption could be overcome by other evidence that indicated that that was not the intent of the parties for it to be agricultural real estate. But short of that, short of some contest and some proof demonstrated by someone that it wasn't intended to be agricultural real estate, it's going to be treated as agricultural real estate. So I really believe the presumption is appropriate, and I believe that it cuts the right way, which the way it cuts is it says if the mortgage recites the real estate's agricultural real estate, it's presumed that it is. And I think that's the way we want it. Now, not to say that some mortgage couldn't have, who knows what somebody could do with their word processor, and maybe that creeps into a document through some careless word processing when there was not an intention to have it there. Well, the presumption is going to be that it's agricultural real estate, but that could be overcome by somebody coming in saying, no, that was a mistake. It wasn't supposed to be. But it puts the burden on the person who's going to say it wasn't the intent to make it agricultural real estate to come forward with some proof. Absent them assuming the burden and coming forth, it's going to be taken that it is agricultural real estate. As far as that language relative to the right of redemption, again, that's existing language, and I think that it all has to tie back to the first part of the sentence where it says if it recites it's agricultural real estate, then it says it's presumed that the provisions are all relative to the right of redemption apply. Well, the right of redemption for agricultural real estate is 12 months. And I can only tell you from my own law practice and having done that on numerous occasions, specifically for the purpose of invoking the 12-month period of redemption, that it's worked, at least for me. At least I haven't had anybody stand me on my head in court over it. So I would submit that the language does, it's existing, it's accepted practice, and it does have the effect of saying the 12-month period of redemption is going to be the one that applies. As far as the desire of the banks being a reason, it is true that if these can't be sold on the secondary market, the bank could keep them in-house. The problem the banks are having with that is that these are long-term loans, and they're very awkward, and they're very difficult for banks to keep in-house. And you may remember the S&L crisis, if you were born by then, and everything that went with the S&L crisis. But that's what they were all about, is they had short-term money on the deposit side, and they had long-term obligations on the liability side. Well, actually, banking's always backwards. The liabilities are... the loans are on the asset side, the deposits are on the liability side. But anyway, they had short-term money loaned out on long-term obligations. And so when the rates changed on the short-term money and went against the interest rates they had on their long-term commitments, they had no answer, and it broke a lot of them. So the reason the banks want this is they need, in order to provide the financing that people want for these properties, the banks need to be able to sell that. And true, a bank could keep a few in-house. They might keep a couple of 15-year obligations. They might even keep a 30-year obligation in-house, but they aren't going to keep very many of them because all their money that's in the bank that they're funding those with is short-term money. And so if you're locked in at a 30-year obligation at some interest rate with short-term money and your short-term cost of funds starts jumping around while your long-term obligation holds constant, then you start to get into the S&L problem. I don't know how many parcels are involved. I just can't answer that. As far as how it comports with the definition of agricultural real estate elsewhere, I'm not aware of any other statutory definition of agricultural real estate that would relate to this.
Representative Floyd Escobel.
Chairman, I was just wondering why 80 acres? Why not 40, or why not 100? Where did the 80 come from? And if it was explained, I guess maybe I missed it. And also, I was wondering what tax implications might there be by this change?
Representative Brechtel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my only question, first of all, is what does the ag industry have to say about this, and maybe some of the little landholders? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shepherdson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Speaking on and for the bill, being a past banker or a banker in the past life, it's hard to find financing for these tweener properties. They're too small to be big and too big to be small. The ag lenders don't want to lend on them because they aren't production value agriculture land. They don't earn enough money off the land to make a living. The banks don't want to lend on them because, as I've stated before, you can't sell them on the secondary market. This bill would give people more options for financing. It's good for our consumers. There is getting to be a lot of these people who want the house in 30 acres, 40 acres, 70 acres. Again, they're tweener properties. They just don't fit right now in with the current financing standards. Again, what does the ag industry think of this? It has no effect on the ag industry. If you're an ag producer, you can still get lending from your traditional banks for agriculture loans. You can get ag lending from ag lenders, like the good lender from the middle of the state. It basically provides our consumers with more options on and for the bill.
Representative Brown.
Just two more quick things, Mr. Chairman. Number one, why is it 80? I don't know, except it's 2 times 40. There's a lot of 40-acre subdivisions out there. It would allow a person to own two of them or approaching two of them, 235s or 70. That's the best explanation that I can provide. The other thing that it does do for the ag industry, as was just stated, the ag industry is in favor of this. The one thing it does for them is if they want to spin off a piece of property and mortgage that on a home loan, right now they're limited to 20 acres with that particular home, as they frequently do. They frequently take a part of the ranch, isolate it in a different ownership, and then get a home loan on it. Well, right now they can put 20 acres with it. This would allow them to go up to 80 acres with that home. So in that respect, it's a benefit.
Representative Mercer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I still am wondering how many of these parcels we're talking about. If you have any numbers that help us understand the scope of this issue. And again, are there other definitions of ag property that help us understand maybe that 80-acre provision?
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, no other definitions that I'm aware of. And as far as how many parcels, I cannot answer that. But when you look at the state border to border and what's going on, there are a tremendous number of 40-acre parcels out there, 35-acre parcels out there that would qualify. And right now they can't get this kind of funding. And those people would be better off if we pass this, because then they can more easily get the funding, long-term funding that they need for those from a bank, because the bank has a place to put them in the secondary market. So on and for the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate file number 4 do pass, please say aye. Those opposed? No. Senate File 4 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File Number 9. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 9, introduced by the Management Audit Committee, an act relating to the Uniform Management of Public Employee Retirement System Act. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes: Alden, Bigby, Buchanan, Dockstetter, Mercer, Olson, Shepherdson, Throne. No: Gingrey. Signed, Representative Buchanan.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Buchanan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 9 do pass. And just a brief explanation of the bill, I guess, before we get to the committee of the whole amendment. This bill basically came through the Senate and over here because there were concerns of liability for board members at the retirement board. And as you can see there, on page 2, subsection E, it basically says there that as provided in the Wyoming Governmental Claims Acts, the individual board members would be granted immunity and liability while acting within the scope of administering and operating the retirement system and would not be personally liable for breaches of fiduciary duties except in cases of willful misconduct and gross negligence. And the fear basically was is that you've got these folks who are serving on this board who don't have always have all the expertise and means to fully make always informed decisions about perhaps the retirement portfolio. And they really relied a lot on outside sources and experts and portfolio managers. And it was just deemed that to encourage more participation, folks serving on the board, and also protecting them for things that were deemed to probably being beyond their realm of experience, that they should be provided some type of protection from liability, especially personal liability. And there is a committee of the whole amendment, and I would defer to the good representative from Jackson for an explanation of that and the movement of that.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move committee of the whole amendment number 1. Let me start from explaining a little bit about what we did back in 2005. Back in 2005, we adopted a new policy for the retirement board, and that policy was we passed the Uniform Act that deals with public employee retirement systems. And we agreed as a body in 2005 to make sure that the retirement board were liable for the decisions that they make. And part of that also, we put in there that the retirement board can buy insurance, and it's just normal E&O insurance, for the board members, so there would be insurance covering them, but that they did not get the immunity that other boards are entitled to. Almost all boards, actually I think I could pretty much say all boards, in the state of Wyoming, if you're a volunteer on one of our state boards, you're covered under the Governmental Claims Act and you're immune from the actions that you take. Back in 2005, we made the decision that the retirement board would not be immune. And the reason for that being is that they are in control of quite a large sum of money. And back in 2005, just to remind you, this was about the time period where a lot of changes were coming because some of the other states, their retirement plans had not done well. I won't say they were raided, but there wasn't a lot of oversight. People had gotten on these boards, sort of had just voted as, you know, the folks tell them to vote, and it was somewhat passive supervision in these other states, not our state. And so states started looking at ways to improve their retirement boards to make sure that the money is actually there when people go to retire. And as you've seen in some of the private sector, when people go to retire, sometimes the pension plans are no longer there or they are much weaker. So we made this decision in 2005 that we would, that the retirement board were liable. And essentially what it says is they, for all their duties, and the duties you don't have in front of you, but if you look in the statutes, the duties are listed there, and essentially, I'll just paraphrase, it's to make sure, you know, the money stays there, the money doesn't disappear. What the board was concerned about is this personal liability on themselves. So what they came back with was this idea that they're immune, and if you look on the bill on page 2, line 12-13, they put in this term, who by willful misconduct or gross negligence. Well, the problem with that is, using that type of language, you've essentially gutted what we did back in 2005. It takes away that policy decision. And if that's what we want to do, I think the better way of just getting rid of the 2005 Act, because by putting this provision in, it takes away most of the meat of what we did back in 2005. Because when you look at willful misconduct or gross negligence, that's not really what we were after. I mean, that's criminal, usually. That's somebody intentionally was stealing the money. What we're trying to get at is that you're not following your duties by sitting there passively and letting the money managers actually make the decisions, and the board ends up just being a rubber stamp. But we understood their concerns, and that's why the good chairman of Judiciary and I came forward with this Committee of the Whole amendment, which sort of, I think, goes to their concern, but also keeps the act that we passed in 2005 intact. Because what they're looking for is some protection, and that clearly is understood. These are volunteers primarily that get onto this board, and of course you don't want to be liable, you know, for some one of your acts. So what we did, we looked at the corporate statutes, and when can you sue a director of a corporate board? In the private world, and in our statutes, this is what we have. Essentially, what we have in our statutes is, for the corporate, is in discharging any of your duties under the Act, that you're entitled to rely on information, opinions, reports, statements, financial statements, or other financial data if they're prepared and presented by employees or officers of the retirement board, the legal counsel, public accountants of the board, or a committee of the board, which you're not a member of. So maybe they create a subcommittee to look at one issue, and you're not a member of it, and you relied on them. And what it goes on to say is, you're not acting in good faith if he has knowledge concerning the matter that makes reliance otherwise permitted. And it goes on to say, you're not liable for any action taken as a trustee or any failure to take any action if you perform the duties of your office in compliance with this subsection. And then we repeat the subsection in another the section and another section of the bill. So essentially, this is providing what they need. They need that protection, but we're not going as far as they wanted. What they wanted was essentially get rid of any liability on them. And what this is doing, the Committee of the Whole amendment, is saying, you know what, if you rely on the lawyers and on the accountants and on the information presented to you, yes, then you're not liable. But if you're doing things that you shouldn't be doing, then you are liable. That's what the Committee of the Whole amendment does. It sort of meets in the middle, doesn't get rid of the 2005 Act, but it doesn't go as far as some of the members of the retirement board wanted to go. It's sort of a middle ground idea.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman. I urge the body to resist this Committee of the Whole amendment. And let me just visit a little bit about this. Wyoming happens to be the only state that has adopted, I think it's called UMPRESA, and it's this Uniform Public Employees Retirement Act or whatever. The only state. That is turning out to be how onerous this is. This was presented to us by a great and perhaps returning freshman legislator, and I don't think we really fully understood the implications of this. What it has resulted in is the retirement system board has been singled out to be treated entirely different than any other board and held to be personally liable for decisions that are made and the outcomes of that could result from those decisions. And there's no other board in the state that's held personally liable. And so what does that cause the board to do? Well, it happens that in investing, whenever you're looking at a number of assets, some of those assets really have a lot of risk with them. But when they're included with other assets, it actually lowers your overall risk. But it's caused the board to be reluctant to enter into a contract for some of those things like private equity funds, certain hedge funds, because the risk is so high that if they could be held personally liable, they're unwilling to do that. So consequently, that could result in lower returns overall. the board was considering asking the legislature to repeal the entire act, because already that board is covered by the imprudent investors rule, by trust legislation that we have in statute. And this just was a particularly onerous requirement and cloud hanging over the board. So the board went to the AG's office, and the AG is the one that drew up the language in here that says, okay, we need to treat you like the other boards in the state, and this will do it. And so they brought this bill forward. Now, the problem that I see with the Committee of the Whole amendment isn't necessarily that the intent isn't good, but these are corporate duties, and I think that there's excluded a lot of things that the retirement board does. Some things just by omission. For example, in the list of people that they can take advice and opinions and information from, there's a number of advisors and of managers of funds that aren't listed here. The portion that says where you take into account there was a portion in here that had to do with little C, where a committee of the board where you could entitled to rely on information's opinions and so on presented by a committee of the board of which he's not a committee member if the trustee reasonably believes the committee merits confidence. Well, there are several committees on the board, and they do make recommendations to the rest of the board. And what if they choose not to follow that committee's recommendations? And I've seen that before, where a committee will look at something fairly closely, but there'll be other members who aren't on the committee and who, for good reason, decides, well, they aren't going to do that. And then would they be held liable for not doing that? So I really think that the bill, the way it's written, solves the problem and hits the target to a much closer degree. And I'm afraid that the amendment, although written in good faith, is misses the point of what's trying to be accomplished. So I'd urge the body to resist the amendment.
Chairman Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not certainly not a lawyer in any way, but my question is that why are the lawyers on this side of the Capitol so much more up to speed than the ones on the other side? I mean, they have about as many people over there.
Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I presume, looking at this distinguished group of individuals in this body, that probably a lot of you have been on boards. I was on the hospital board some years ago, and we got the hospital was sued, and all the members of the board were sued. They wanted to know all about all of your assets, how much your house was worth. They wanted to know the address of your house and all of these things. And I can tell you that's a very sobering experience. And several of the board members were considering quitting the board. So I think that for that reason, we don't want to lose good people on boards. We want to have people on there that have some assets. And if they do have assets, they're less likely to be on them. For all the statements that the good chairman from Sheridan, those statements that he made, which I very much agree with, I urge that you resist this Committee of the Whole amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, my question isn't on the amendment, so I'll hold off.
Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Primarily, I brought the amendment just to point out that we're making a big policy shift here. We went one way in 2005, and I can recall that debate. We debated it hard. We debated this particular issue of did we want the retirement board to be outside of the purview of immunity? Because I don't think anyone disagrees that all our other boards, they should be immune. We certainly don't want them to restrict those folks from getting on the board. What we talked about in 2005, though, was this is a little bit different. This is someone controlling a large sum of money, and this decisions can be made very quickly, very fast. A money manager comes in, makes a suggestion as to investments, and all of a sudden we have some problems with our retirement system. The beneficiaries, meaning the state employees that are on this system, should have a mechanism to come in and to sue, to find out what went wrong on the retirement board. And it sounds, from most of the examples, it sounds not intentional acts. It's mostly passivity, where they're allowing perhaps a money manager. This is what's gone wrong in other states, where they allow a money manager to essentially run the show, and they become a rubber stamp. And I don't believe that's happened here, but that was the issue back in 2005 that we were discussing. I would point out to you that the amendment that the bill that we passed in 2005 allowed for the retirement system to buy insurance for those members that get on the board, and for whatever reason in committee we discussed this, the retirement system never did that, and that would have actually solved a lot of this problem if they had just bought that insurance, some E&O insurance. That's essentially what the amendment does. What I was concerned about is that we debated this hard, I don't know what that is, 4 years ago, and now we're going in the exact opposite direction. I just wanted to be able to point that out.
Is there any further discussion in Committee of the Whole? Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, just a little more information for the body. The retirement system does have four electors on it who do have backgrounds in investing. And I can assure you that they do not let the money managers just run at will nor follow their advice without challenge and question. And that's one of the refreshing things about that board. There are a number on there that don't have expertise, and that might be a conversation for the future. I might also just share that I think a lot of us, when this passed in 2005, didn't fully understand it. It was one of those giant, big, uniform bills, multi-pages, and it went through without too much questioning. One thing I do recall, though, is the enactment clause was put off like a year and a half afterwards because there was a lot of fear and uncertainty that we didn't know what was in there, and we wanted to give the retirement board time to look at that. It seems like we made some changes last year, and then this came up as being a constraint that even risk whether or not some of the individuals would want to continue serving on the board.
Any further discussion in the Committee of the Whole Amendment? We're on Committee of the Whole Amendment number one. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number one, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
The amendment fails. Is there any discussion on the bill? Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if anyone understands the amendment to page 2 of the bill, lines 12 and 13. When I look at the engrossed copy, this appears to be the only change. And it said in the original bill, on line 13, the words, or other fiduciary who, those words were right after trustee on line 12. So it read, a trustee or other fiduciary who by willful misconduct or gross negligence breaches a duty imposed. And it looks like the words, or other fiduciary who, were moved down to line 13, but the definition of fiduciary includes a trustee. So I just wonder if that change makes any sense. When we say now in the bill, a trustee who by willful misconduct or gross negligence breaches a duty, and then we say, or other fiduciary who breaches a duty, without the willful misconduct or gross negligence standard, but they're the same person by definition in the statute.
Chairman Landon. Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of reluctant to come to the speaker because it's my answer is going to be a what was called earlier this morning a WG. Because this was changed over in the Senate side, so I'm going to assume that they wanted to keep this standard for the 9 or 11, however many trustees are on the board. But other fiduciaries might include people who are managing the funds, and they wouldn't necessarily want to hold them to that same standard. But that literally, Mr. Chairman, that's a wag. I shouldn't have come to this microphone.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and this answers the good doctor's question from earlier. There actually are some smart attorneys on the other end. The reason they did that, if you look at the definition of fiduciary, a trustee is just one of the things a fiduciary can be, but a fiduciary is also exercises any discretionary authority to manage. That would be an employee. Exercise any authority to invest or manage, potentially be one of the money managers that they've hired, providing investment advice. So the fiduciary has more folks are included within that definition. A trustee is very specific. That is the board member who has the ultimate authority to make the decision. The concern was that you were, if you left fiduciary in that first part, giving them the willful misconduct or gross negligence out, that was not who we were trying to help. We were trying to help the actual board members, these volunteers. We weren't trying to help the professionals that may be advising the trustees. That was the distinction that they made on the other end, and that's why they took fiduciary out, and so it would just cover the board members.
Representative Brown.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that only confuses me more. First of all, in the language that's added in lines 1 through 8 on page 2, we ought to bear in mind that that gives the individual board members the benefit of the Wyoming Governmental Claims Act. And the Wyoming Governmental Claims Act says that they enjoy immunity under the Wyoming Governmental Claims Act so long as they act within the scope of their duties. Now, if they get outside of the scope of their duties, they're personally liable. The Governmental Claims Act will protect them if they're within the scope. And then it goes on and even says, if they're accused of something, the board makes an initial determination whether the board thinks they acted within the scope or not. And if they did, the board defends them, sort of like under a reservation of rights and insurance. And then again, after the final determination's made, then the board once again determines, were they acting within the scope or not? And if they were, they're protected. And if they weren't, they aren't. So they've got to stay within the scope of their duties. But now this language that's added on line 12 and 13 on page 2 seems to vary that. And it actually gives the trustee more leeway than an employee. An employee who breaches a duty is personally liable, but a trustee is not unless his breach was willful misconduct or gross negligence. So the trustee can do a lot more bad stuff than the employee and still not be hooked. But what really troubles me about that language is it seems to be in conflict with the Governmental Claims Act, which says they're going to be protected as long as they stay within the scope of their duty. So I have a lot of problems with that language that's in there, Mr. Chairman. Unless somebody can make me comfortable with that, I'm going to vote no on it just because I think this bill is in conflict with itself.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? Representative Gingrey.
Mr. Chairman, I would just urge the body to vote no. I think the proper thing to do is come back and maybe repeal the entire Uniform Management of Public Employees Retirement Act. But to come in and just take a little tiny piece out of it, and that tiny piece actually ends up essentially gutting the whole thing, I just don't think that's the way to come. I think we should have a debate on why we adopted the Uniform Act in the first place, and there was a lot of good things in that act, and there was a lot of good reasons why we spent a lot of time working on that bill 4 years ago. I would urge you to vote no, and we come back next year and work this out.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I spent a lot of time trying to get these gray cells working again, trying to remember back when we did this big change. And I don't remember that we thought that this might be as detrimental to the board. I thought we were doing something that would be better for the plan and make the plan more whole. We weren't talking about the possible liability as it could create for the board. So I would urge the body to support the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would urge everyone to vote aye at this point so we could maybe look at this further. I know there's some consternation about it at the moment, but I hate to see a committee bill that's been worked over the interim and pass one body die on a general file vote because we're confused about it.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I'd urge everyone to vote aye also. I think that, we've shined some light on this. There are a lot of things in MPRESA that are also in the Prudent Investors Act and in the trust language that we have in the in our statutes. We could very well, it could be very prudent to go ahead and repeal that act. But in the meantime, I think that in order to have a good functioning board, we should go ahead with this. I also don't want to discourage those who have some questions about it to consider second reading amendments and see whether or not there's some language that can accomplish the goals and bring the comfort level up for them also.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Buchanan's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 9 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File Number 9 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 17. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 17, introduced by the School Facilities Committee, an act relating to school facilities infrastructure costs. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Kraft, Davison, Dirks, Goggles, Yagi, McComey, Teeters, Wallace, White, signed representing McComey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 17 do pass, and I will turn the explanation of the bill over to the good gentleman from House District 2.
Representative Dirks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We bring you Senate File 17, School Facilities Infrastructure Costs. And what the School Facilities Commission saw, and especially many of you in your communities as some of these new school buildings were being built, is that costs would arise that were not exactly foreseen in the construction of the building. Most frequently, costs involving roads or sewer systems or things like that, especially if the building was not being built on the same site as the original. And so this bill attempts to ensure some compatibility between the communities and the commission. And sometimes that's difficult to put in a statute, of course. But you'll see on pages 2 and 3 the line again and again, in order to deliver quality educational services. This was the line that the commission needed to really ascertain that that's their bottom line. That's really what they're looking for as they're dealing with the communities. And I think you'll find over on page 3, the key lines, go to line 17 at the end of it, it'll say, expenditures from the school capital construction account shall be for necessary and related costs to implement efficient and cost-effective building and facility remedies required to deliver quality educational services. And that's the essence of the bill, and we would urge approval. Thank you.
Is there any discussion on the bill? Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question on the bill.
when it talks about in the state's best interest, and we're talking about a road that's going to the new school, if the road didn't exist before, or if it was a dirt street and they'd like to pave it, how does this equate to what is the best interest of the state? Is it that the state won't have to pay for it and the community picks up the tab? I mean, I don't know what that means.
Representative Dirks.
As I understand it, the bill is attempting to require cooperation between the commission and the various entities. And I can't say any more than that. Maybe the good chairman has some information that I don't.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the essence of this bill is to establish some type of communication and dialogue between the cities and the School Facilities Commission. We have funded money to cooperate, and testimony in committee was such an example that was given. We will have to run an 8-inch water main to the up the street that's being built to the school, but the cities would like to have a 12-inch main because they could take beyond that, they could be able to take water beyond that, and so they reach an agreement for the oversize of the pipe. The cities would pay for the oversize of the pipe, and some type of an agreement that when those pipes are tapped for individual residences or a subdivision development, that there be some way that some of that money would come back, flow back to the state as well as the city. So it's a way to share in the costs and try and reach some amicable agreement between cities and the School Facilities Commission.
Any further discussion? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 17 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Senate File 17 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 32. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 32, introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to parole changes in the length of parole. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Alden, Begbie, Buchanan, Dockstetter, Gingrey, Mercer, Olson, Shepperson, Throne, signed Representative Buchanan, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Buchanan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 32 do pass and would defer to the good representative from House District 58 for an explanation.
Representative Shepperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of this bill is to basically provide management tools to achieve a more successful release of inmates to parole. And that goal is desirable for two reasons. Number one, more successful paroles reduces our prison overcrowding in the short run through shorter incarcerations and less returns. Right now, over 30% of the prison intakes are due to parole and probation revocations. More importantly, the second reason is parole supervision protects the public safety in the short run by providing a period of community supervision after release. Rather than have the inmates just walk out cold with no rehabilitation, this provides them with some restrictions, some monitoring, and support throughout their probation period. So basically, in the long run, attendance to rehabilitative programming required before the board grants a parole, and with continuation of the needed programs in the community and assistance with reintegration while on parole, provides benefits of reduced recidivism. So amendments to 713-408 will basically authorize the Department of Corrections, probation and parole agents to impose intermediate sanctions in lieu of revocations on all 700 parolees rather than just on the 40 or so that are currently on the intensive supervision program as authorized by our current legislation. Some of the sanctions that may be imposed for violations are loss or restriction of privileges, community service, restrictions on personal liberty, including detention at the county jail, or placement as a residential community correctional program. It's hoped that the availability of these sanctions will act as a deterrent against parolees committing violations and will send a corrective message to violators which may modify future parole performance. Obviously, reducing returns to prison will help with crowding issues and the state costs of incarceration will be reduced. Amendments to 713.420 will authorize the governor, in consultation with the Department of Corrections and the board, to adopt rules providing good time awards to parolees. Parolees would have the ability to earn time off for their parole periods for good performance and would be subject to having it removed for bad performance. And this would provide, again, a management tool with some anticipated benefits, which would remove the disincentive for some inmates who don't ask for parole because they want to just go ahead and finish their sentence as soon as possible and then just walk out cold. Again, we know the results of that. It would give parolees an incentive to perform well so that their sentence is completed sooner, and it would provide a deterrent to violations because of the possible sanctions of losing earned credits. And again, as a net result, this would be more successful paroles, and which would have more successful reintegration into the community and overall less strain on our prison system. That's a general overview of the bill and would stand for any questions.
Any questions on the bill? Question having been called. All those in favor of Chairman Buchanan's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 32 do pass, please say aye. Those opposed, no. Senate File 32 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 44. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 44, introduced by the Mineral Committee, an act related to the Wyoming Residential Mortgage Practices Act. This bill was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Edmonds, Escobel F., Hammonds, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Quarburg, Stewart. Signed, Representative Lockhart, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Lockhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that bill number, Senate file number 44 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments. I'm going to use an expression I haven't used since I left Korea a long time ago. Listen up. We're going to try something a little different here. We're going to present a trifecta on this bill so that you fully get the value of it. We'll start with two committee members who heard this in the interim. They heard it in committee in 08, and then we're going to follow up with a practitioner in the area, and that will be her first explanation. That said, I'd like to call on the good representative from my lucky number 27, House District 27, to explain the bill, and then we'll move it from there to others to make sure you understand it completely.
Representative Hammonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 44, as my good chairman told you, is something that we have been working on the Minerals, Business, and Economic Development Committee for some time. It's a Residential Mortgages Practices Act. And even though we've been working on it, it is of particular importance right now because of the national situation with our mortgages and the houses across the country. In Wyoming, our current situation is such that we have full employment with rising wages, and at the same time we have a tight housing market with lots of residential property appreciation. This is the perfect magnet that led the country to the situation they have with some very bad practices with lending for mortgages. And because of the situation in the other states, Wyoming could potentially become a magnet with our rising wages and rising appreciation of houses. And for that reason, this bill is of more importance than if it was just, as we started out looking at it, just trying to clean up our residential mortgage practice. Anyway, because we feel that it's so critical, we've asked my good colleague from House District 36 in Casper to explain it to you because as a practitioner, she is more familiar with all of the ins and outs of it. And for that reason, I would ask, Mr. Chair, that you allow her to introduce the bill for her inaugural time at the mic.
Representative Hales.
Thank you, Representative from House District 27 and Mr. Speaker. I would urge the support of House Bill 44. There is no significant fiscal or personnel impact of this bill. The Division of Banking currently administers the Wyoming Residential Mortgage Practice Act and conducts periodic examination of licensees to ensure compliance with the Act. This bill does alter and clarify some of the requirements of licensees, but the examination function will not change, and the revenue generated from these examinations will not change. This bill allows the Division of Banking to participate in the nationwide mortgage licensing system and database. The current license application fees are sufficient to cover the use of this system, and the application fees will not change. There are three important players in this bill. There's the borrower, who is represented by you and I. Then there is the mortgage lender, who takes the loan application and, along with the title company, closes the loan. When the loan is closed, the mortgage lender is out of the picture. The third player is the mortgage banker. When the loan is closed, it is then sold to the mortgage banker, and you may make your payments to the mortgage banker, or they may sell them the loan to someone else. As our good representative from House District 27 said, mortgage lenders who have had little or no regulation and advantage has been taken of buyers who may not understand the terms, and they buy a house once or twice in a lifetime. If you would turn with me to page 7, I'd like to go over these two important sections with you. They are Romanette 1, which is the disclosure of terms of the loan to the borrower in compliance with the disclosure requirements of the Federal Truth in Lending Act, and also the Federal Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act. It is extremely important that any borrower understand the terms that they're securing their loan under, and that these are in writing and disclosed to the borrower at the time of loan application. Romanette 2 is also an extremely important one. Many of the young borrowers have been caught in this. If a prepayment penalty is a condition of the residential mortgage loan offered to a borrower, that fact shall be separately disclosed in writing to the borrower, and the borrower shall agree in writing to accept that condition. The disclosure shall state that a prepayment penalty provision imposes a charge if the borrower refinances or pays off the mortgage loan before the date for repayment. And the reason for this, there are penalties that can amount to several thousand dollars in this prepayment penalty clause. I will be happy to answer any questions.
Any further discussion on the bill? Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not really a question, but just a statement that getting the word out in language that people understand is so important, because it is the biggest investment most people make in their lives, and particularly the first-time buyers, they have a lot to learn. So I think this is an improvement. I'd urge your positive support of Senate File 44.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like a little more explanation of the bill. On page 2, 4023-103, powers and duties of the commissioner. And then on to page 3, we're requiring the licensee, and I'm assuming licensee does not include a bank, just a mortgage broker or mortgage lender. We're requiring the licensee to reimburse the borrower for actual damages for any amount in excess of amounts actually disclosed to the borrower. Do we do that in banking now? And would banks want to do that same thing? Require a background investigation, including fingerprint checks for state and national criminal history records as necessary. And the rest of Romanet 8. And then 9, line 15, the commissioner may require applicants to utilize a nationwide mortgage licensing system and database for the processing of applications and fees. We don't do that with banks. I think there's some things in 4023-103 that we don't realize are in the bill unless we read it and understand the full import of that. And I find it interesting in the discussion about the 80-acre agricultural exemption. You know, those 40-acre parcels or the tweeners may be the only ones who can get funding through a mortgage broker who's not a local bank. And we're making it more onerous for those brokers because of what's happened nationally and the subprime mortgage problem. Remember, subprime is really low subprime. It's not the secondary market. It's even below the secondary market. It's subprime. And certainly there are problems there, but if I as a borrower go to a mortgage broker and say, I want to borrow 100% and I don't want to give you any documents. And they say, fine, you're going to have to pay this. And I say, great. And to me, to understand that there's a prepayment penalty, that's the least of it. Everybody ought to understand that there's a prepayment penalty on your mortgage because it'll say it right in the document. And if it doesn't, then there is no prepayment penalty. But it's the other things about how you can buy down the interest rate and hide fees on the back end and all kinds of things that happen whether you're a mortgage broker or a banker. So I just wonder if this is really fair, and first of all, whether there is a problem in Wyoming that we're trying to fit into a national problem. So I'd like a little more explanation on 103, and then I haven't had a chance to look at this bill much at all, but when I look through it, like page 5 at the top, Romanet 3, this is an application for license may be granted if the commissioner finds the applicant has not been convicted of any felony or a misdemeanor involving any aspect of the business, and then that was changed over to Romanet 3. The applicant has not been convicted of a misdemeanor involving mortgage lending or any aspect of the mortgage lending business or any offense involving breach of trust or fraudulent or dishonest dealing. Does that apply to everybody in the mortgage business? I don't think so. Then on page 8, you're supposed to give a good faith estimate of settlement costs within 3 business days after accepting an application from the borrower. Well, you don't even have the appraisal yet. It takes weeks to get an appraisal. I could give a good faith estimate of settlement costs based on what I knew at that time that might be 100% off. If the intent is really to tell the person accurately what their settlement costs are going to be? Why does it have to be within 3 days of the estimate? Is that just so? I don't quite understand that. The disclosure shall subsequently be provided by the lender and signed by the borrower at the same time the borrower is given the final Federal Truth in Lending Act disclosure. So you have to give a good faith estimate within 3 days, and then it has to be signed whenever you sign the final Truth in Lending disclosure. I could go on, but I think I'll stop there. I'd like to read the bill more fully, but those are the questions that come to mind.
Chairman Lockhart. Representative Hales.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll try and answer the questions brought up by my good friend from up north. Mortgage brokers and mortgage lenders are held to a different standard than bankers, and that's because of their charter. Mortgage lenders have less restrictive requirements than do bankers. As far as background checks are concerned, there have been numerous mortgage lenders that have been convicted of misdemeanors and felonies, certainly in the area where I come from, to the point that they are no longer in business. What you have when you have the kind of market that we have are marginal lenders who can come in with very little investigation, set up an office in their house, and there's really very few restrictions placed upon them. As those of us in the real estate industry, we have background checks. We also provide bonds. We're fingerprinted. And I would think that someone who handles a great deal of money would be held to that kind of a standard also. Let's see. And as far as the good faith estimate is concerned, the normal practice is to give that estimate at the time that you apply for the loan, because you normally have a contract pending with a closing date on it. Appraiser fees are set. You know what the taxes are. You know what your closing costs are going to be. And frankly, it's all very computerized, and you can give it to them right there. The real estate industry is required by law to do a good faith estimate at the time a contract is written, and then another one is done when you apply for a loan, and then another one is done at the time of settlement. So you have three checks on that. Are there any other questions?
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In addition to the explanation that you just heard of some of the details, as I mentioned, this was an interim committee bill. We had extensive testimony from the real estate industry, the Bankers Association, the Banking Commissioner, and the rigor that we've put into this is not all that unusual for those people that will be looking at your records, and you want them to meet those kinds of standards. I believe that there was no one that testified after the bill had been through the first couple drafting efforts that spoke against the detail that we put into this and the importance of it. As was mentioned by the good representative from House District 27, by and large, the state of Wyoming has dodged the mortgage subprime lending crisis that's in the United States, and that's because of the direct involvement of those in the banking industry, and they support this, so I would urge your support of the bill.
Any further discussion on the bill? Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the answers to some of the questions. Did you hear any testimony in committee about how long it takes to process an application? And then why are we changing the expiration date to December 31st? Is that just so we're going to use a calendar year rather than the state budget year? And then on the 3 days, again, is it defined as when you accept the application? Is that, when is that, when does that occur? And I'll stand for questions on that, or answers to that right now.
Representative Hales.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Normally, a loan can be closed within 30 days. Sometimes the contract will run 60 days, but that's one of the conditions of sale, is the closing date. So it's set by contract.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was a question on the calendar year. That was a specific request that was brought to the committee. The details of it I can't remember at this moment, but that was included at the behest of the practitioners in the field.
Any further discussion on the bill? Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I understand what a closing date is. My question is, what is the date of accepting an application, or how is that defined?
Representative Hales.
When an applicant goes into the lender, they bring their documentation. At that point, the lender checks to be sure that they are qualified as far as their financial profile is concerned, that the appraisal is done, that sort of thing, that there are inspections done on the property. And at that point, the lender will say to them, you have loan approval. So it depends upon a number of factors. One, the type of property they're buying, and the due diligence that is required. But I would think you would have approval within 5 to 7 days.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to belabor this, but why would a mortgage lender order an appraisal unless the application, they were willing to accept that borrower and order the appraisal, which then becomes a charge to the buyer, whether it closes or not. So I don't see that if acceptance of the application is when everything's done, and I now know that we're tied contractually, but that's not how it works. The way it works is you go to the broker, they shoot you some options, and you then say, okay, I could do that. And it might be contingent upon the appraised value of the property. And if it doesn't appraise for enough, the contractual relationship might terminate there. Just as a real estate contract might, if it doesn't appraise for $200, we don't have a contract. So I'm still concerned that we're setting a timeline in there of 3 business days. That is based upon a time that is not defined, and we're expecting things to occur that don't practically occur that way.
Representative Shepherdson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to try to answer a couple of the questions. It's a little bit of a gray area. Where I used to work, when we started the clock for the 3 days, is when we had a complete application. We had a list that we would give to our applicants, and we needed a filled out application, a balance sheet, 3 years income statements, an authorization for release of information, credit information. When we had all of that checked off, then we sent them a letter saying, we have received your complete application. Here is your good faith estimate. And that had to be done within 72 hours, and we had certain things we had to do, but it had to be after we received everything we possibly could have received from them. But we would not have done anything on our part that would have incurred any fees. We would not have pulled a credit bureau. We would not have started an appraisal, done anything on our part until we received everything and then provided them those documents back. I'm not sure on the wording on this. I would like to check with some of the other. It's just basically, this is the same as any other consumer lending, but I'm not sure if the wording is consistent, and I would like to check on that and maybe come back with a second reading amendment to clarify some of that. I hope that answers some of the questions.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that the good explanation from our most recent most recent legislator from Casper helps. And we will check into this, but that is a question that was handled in committee, and we'll get solid documentation on that. So when second reading comes around, we'll have an answer should anyone bring it up. And I urge your support of the bill and call for the question.
Representative Hales. Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 44 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 44 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 49. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 49, introduced by Senator Von Flattern, an act relating to taxation and revenue regarding impact assistance payments. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Anderson, Escobel, Kay, Gilmore, Lubno, Madden, Miller, Semlek, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 49 do pass. And I would remind the body that whenever we're dealing with sales tax issues, there's always two parts of the statutes that we have to consider, both the use tax and the sales tax, and their exact copies of each other. So all we really have to do is talk about one of them, and it goes into the other part. Turn the explanation of the bill over to my good friend with the back, the representative from Casper.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, this bill is a correction of a bill that you'll remember last year we passed out of the House. Mr. Speaker and I sponsored that bill. It was to give locals the option of passing one more optional percent sales tax. And so currently, of course, we have the 4 cent sales tax. And previously, then, in addition to the state four, locals could pass one general purpose tax and one kind of special purpose, or usually a facilities type tax. And there's some carve outs for economic development and lodging, those things, but really I don't want to confuse the issue. They could pass 2 additional cents. Well, we passed that bill, which had been tried many times over the years, giving them the ability to pass a third local tax. Well, really in an oversight to gather impact assistance funds, or industrial siting funds as they're commonly called, locals have to have a maximum of their taxes assessed. And if you will look over on page 3 of the bill, this is really the crux of the bill down on line 14. This was probably the most worked bill over the summer. It was one that legal staff, it's a simple concept, but it took a lot of work to get it right and to kind of close up all the loopholes. In a nutshell, this bill basically turns it back to exactly the way it was before. And so the way it was before, to assess the maximum, you had to have 1% general purpose. And or if you didn't have the 1% general purpose, and you'd have to have 2% projects. What we unintentionally did was make folks, local folks, have 2% general purpose and 1% project. Or, if I said that right, 2% general purpose or 1% general purpose and 2% project. So we forced them to assess an extra penny. That wasn't the intent of the bill. The intent was just to give folks an option to assess themselves. So this bill, I think, although I hate to predict it, should be a slam dunk. This is an oversight, and we want to correct this, and it's been worked on all summer. And I certainly don't want to boldly predict that, but I would really appreciate your support, and I would stand for any questions.
Any discussion on the bill? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 49 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 49 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 52. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 52, introduced by Management Council, an act relating to construction of statutes, boards, and commissions compensation. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Alden, Begbie, Buchanan, Dockstetter, Mercer, Olson, Shepperson. No, Gingrey, Throne. Signed, Representative Buchanan, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Buchanan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 52 do pass. And ladies and gentlemen, this is a bill that had come from Management Council, started on the Senate side and then came over through Judiciary. And basically what this bill does, the crux of it, is on page 2. If you look at subparagraph 9, it's talking about boards and commissions and their compensation. And recently, and I don't remember exactly when, but in Title 28 for legislative pay, we've recently, and I think it starts in January of 09, but we will be entitled to claim salary for meeting preparation days and salary for travel days as provided in Title 28. Chapter 5, Article 1, and for whatever reason, I'm not sure, maybe some members of Management Council can explain better than I can, but it was deemed that they needed to specify that the compensation for these board members would not include salary or compensation for meeting preparation days or for travel days. Rather, they would only be entitled to salary and per diem and compensation for the days they met as a board.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question having been called. All those in favor of Chairman Buchanan's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 52 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 52 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 61. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 61, introduced by the Education Committee, an act relating to school finance recapture payments. This bill was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Kraft, Davison, Dirks, Goggles, Yagi, McComey, Teeters, White, No, Wallace. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman McComey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that I do so with the recommendation that Senate File 61 do pass. And, Mr. Chairman, I will turn the explanation of the bill over to the good gentleman from my country, Fremont County, at the other end of the chamber.
Representative Goggles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 61 is the school finance recapture payments. Senate File 61 modifies the schedule of payments of amounts recaptured from those school districts whose local resources exceed foundation program guaranteed levels effective school year 2008-2009. On your bill, the schedule is on page 1 under 2113-102. That schedule changes from this current schedule to January 15th, March 15th, May 15th of each year in equal payments of 25% and the balance to be paid on June 15th. The other addition is on page 2, line 4 and 5, as estimated to the district on or before August 15th, and that's the second. The third change is a deletion on page 3, and that is the 50% of the amount received on or before January 31st of the school year, in which received and shall repay the 50%, remaining 50%, by June 15th. Under the proposal, the recapture payment schedule requires those quarterly payments with the final settlement on June 15th of each school year. The repayment date for entitlement loan payments, this is for those 9 affected school districts. You can see those on your fiscal note and the attached. It's extended to repayments by June 15th of each school. Current law requires 50% repayment by January 31st of each school year in which received. That's the crux of the payment, the recapture from recapture districts. There's also a matrix on the back page, the third page, that shows the 9 affected districts, the full recapture of the guarantee. And the current law, loan issue equals 1/3 guarantee to recapture districts in August. Partial repayment equal to 1/2 loan due from districts in January. Recapture remainder of loan balance due from districts in June. The proposal, as I've before mentioned, is the recapture loan of 1/3 guarantee payment to district in August. Again, those dates, January, March, May 14th, and June 1st. Mr. Chairman, we stand for questions on Senate File 61.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 61 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Senate File 61 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 64. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 64, introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to juveniles regarding valid court orders. This bill was referred to Committee No. 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Buchanan, Dockstetter, Gingrey, Mercer, Olson, Shepperson, Throne. Absent, Alden. Signed, Representative Buchanan, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Buchanan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 64 do pass, and I would defer to the good representative from House District 11 for an explanation of the bill.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 64 is a bill that is part of the Judiciary Committee's ongoing assignment and efforts to clean up aspects of our juvenile justice system. And this is also part of a package of bills that will get us further down the path of someday complying with federal juvenile justice requirements, although that's not the primary purpose of this bill. Essentially, this specifies that a child is subject to, or that a child's responsibilities when it's adjudicated for a status offense or delinquency must be provided in a court order, in a valid court order. So essentially, it helps define the obligations of the child and I think is really protective of the child, more protective of the child than our current system, so that in the event that the child is subject to probation, that the revocation of the probation is, or potential revocation of the probation or violations are spelled out in a court order. And if I could point you to page, sorry, it's towards the back. Page 9, one of the important features of the bill is that the terms of the court order must be explained to the child, parents, or legal guardian. Also on page 8, it explains when the child must be interviewed and the time frames for that before a child is placed or committed to a different facility. In summary, the purpose of the bill, I think, is to provide more protection for juveniles in the system and to stress that everything must be spelled out in a court order. And with that, I would be happy to answer questions. And if there are no questions, I'd call for the question.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question having been called. All those in favor of Chairman Buchanan's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 64 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 64 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 68. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 68, introduced by Senator Nicholas, an act relating to judicial retirement. This bill was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Jones, Jorgensen, Peterson, Philp, Warren. No, Harshman. Signed, Representative Philp, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Philp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a do pass recommendation for Senate File 68, Judicial Retirement. And I will turn the explanation of the bill over to the representative from House District 51.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judicial retirement. We've visited this issue over the last few years in trying to adjust the actuarials for judicial retirement. And it's come to our attention again that we need to make some adjustments. And the reason that we're bringing it to you today, too, is that we do have an appropriation on this bill, one-time funding and also for the biennium. And I distributed a sheet for you because it is kind of complicated to understand. But when we revised the judicial retirement system in 1998, we created an unfunded liability. So in 2002, we made a correction for that for a judge when we realized that the old plan reduced the individual's compensation substantially based on what he was being penalized for the time he had put in and getting a reduction in that, not meeting the full age of 65. So if you were to look at number 2 on the handout that I gave you, we've started changing that so that based on the number of years that they work, the amount that goes into their retirement account, the first 5 years is 4%. The next, for the 10 years, it's 3%, then it's 2%, and then beyond that, it's 1%. Typically, we hire a judge at age 49, and they retire at 64. So what I'd like you to do is, if you go to page 3 you'll see that wording there that we've restructured for the age of retirement and the payment of the employee's contribution. What's important on this is that if someone puts money into a retirement fund and then they so choose to leave, whether it be for medical, for a different change in career, their compensation should be what they put into it. And what happened is we found that it was being reduced based on this old plan. So hopefully we now have made the adjustment for this program based on those actuarials, and we've defined the plan, and we hope that we now have the problem corrected. And I would stand for questions.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, this is not so much a question, because I agree with what's being done, but a statement about something that inadvertently happened also. And this is the county court judges. Many of our county court judges that had been in the county court system for several years, because of what had happened and the way the funding went and was left out and back and forth, they were told, well, they could get in this new judicial thing, but they would have to pay their share of the extra money that it would cost them to do it. They're in the regular retirement system. And if they had been there for any length of time at all, the money that would have cost them was huge. And that's another thing that may one of these days come back because of the fairness issue. Because the county court judges have been discriminated against, and we just to highlight, this may be something this body will be looking at in the future. Thank you.
Representative Gilmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my question would be to the bringer, how many judges were inadvertently left out or were shorted? Is it a large numbers?
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am not certain of the total number, but it's very small. And this other circumstance that I showed you on number 5 was one, and I think there may be a couple of other judges that this could currently occur to if they were to opt out. But we have, I think it's 50 altogether in the plan. So thank you.
Representative Corbett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if just for my clarification, if I could just get a brief explanation of comparing how this new system with the judges going from 15 to 4, how to just compare that with what happens with state employees, and then are law enforcement officers treated differently? I just need to get a sense of reference. Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may need some expert help on the law enforcement question. I'm not too familiar with that. I believe with state employees that they pay 50% of that retirement participation. Does that answer the question?
Representative Corbett.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess it looks to me like here probably you're almost vested after 4 years. Am I misinterpreting that correctly, incorrectly, and what is it for a state employee?
I don't know that answer, Mr. Chairman, for a state employee.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. State employees are vested after 4 years, and state employees would have this contribution rate, but it's being picked up, as far as I know, all of the education system, all state employees, almost all county city employees that are in the plan, their contribution rate is being paid as part of their compensation by the state, the county, the Department of Education, or board of trustees. So this is not a lot different, except for this amount is above that 17%.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question having been called. Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Phillips' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 68 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 68 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion carries.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. Senate File 2, recommended do pass. Senate File 3, recommended do pass. Senate File 4, recommended do pass. Senate File 9, recommended do pass. Senate File 17, recommended do pass. Senate File 32, recommended do pass. Senate File 44, recommended do pass. Senate File 49, recommended do pass. Senate File 52, recommended do pass. Senate File 61, recommended do pass. Senate File 64, recommended do pass. Senate File 68, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
Representative Gingrey.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You have heard the motion. All of those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed to the motion signify by saying no. Congratulations, Representative Gingrey. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 164. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 47, Wyoming State Training School Amendments. Ayes 24, noes 5, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 165. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 70, School Finance Amendments. Ayes 29, noes 0, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 166. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below failed to pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 77, Severance Tax Distribution. Ayes 15, noes 14, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 167. Motion to reconsider third reading failed. Mr. Speaker, the motion to reconsider the third reading vote on the bills listed below failed to pass the Senate by the vote indicated. Senate File 77, Severance Tax Distribution. Ayes 10, noes 19, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 168. Committee of the Whole indefinitely postponed. Mr. Speaker, the Senate adopted the Committee of the Whole report failing the bills listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill 66, Revolving Loan Fund Accounts. Ayes 7, noes 22, excused 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Members of the House, we are at that order of business of Senate files on first reading. The first Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 28.
Senate File 28, introduced by Capital Financing.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to public funds, investment of state funds, revisions.
Senate File 28 is referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 71.
Senate File 71, introduced by Senator Schiffer.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to Hathaway Scholarship Program Success Curriculum.
Senate File 71 is referred to Committee Number 4, Education. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 56.
Senate File 56, introduced by the Select Water Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to water development projects, omnibus water bill construction.
Senate File 56 is referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 87.
Senate File 87, introduced by Senator Mockler.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the administration of government capital building restoration.
Senate File 87 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 81.
Senate File 81, introduced by Senator Peterson.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to fire protection districts, new entities.
Senate File 81 is referred to Committee Number 6, Travel. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 18.
Senate File 18, introduced by the Corporations Committee.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to business entities revisions.
Senate File 18 is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 41.
Senate File 41, introduced by Senator Case.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to vacation plats vacating subdivisions.
Senate File 41 is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 84.
Senate File 84, introduced by Senator Job.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the fireman's pension account.
Senate File 84 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 83.
Senate File 83, introduced by Senator Job.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to the Wyoming Retirement System, Retirement Rehired Retirees.
Senate File 83 is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 12.
Senate File 12, introduced by Senator Peterson.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to liquor licenses, dispensing rooms, products sold.
Senate File 12 is referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 31.
Senate File 31, introduced by Senator Hastert.
First reading of the bill.
An act relating to domestic violence counseling period.
Senate File 31 is referred to Committee Number 10, Labor. Representative Dirks.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to remind the body of the Livestock Board presentation at 5 o'clock in Hersler. It deals with foot and mouth disease. And I think there might be some food at the venue as well.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. General file for tomorrow, as it stands right now, will be Senate File 6, Senate File 10, Senate File 51, Senate File 55, Senate File 63, Senate File 67, and Senate File 69. Again, that's 6, 10, 51, 55, 63, 67 and 69. And with that, are there other announcements, Mr. Speaker?
Committee announcements. Chairman Philp.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 2 appropriations will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room 204. We will discuss Senate File 1.
Chairman Samuelson.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 5, Agricultural, State, and Public Lands and Water Resources will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room H11 to hear the following Senate files. Senate File 7, Animal Damage Management Program. Senate File 8, Farm Loan Program. And Senate File 43, Reportable Animal Disease List.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, number 4 will meet upon adjournment and room H10, where we will take up Senate File 21, Engrossed, Hathaway Scholarship Program, And Senate File 22 that was to be taken up has been asked to be laid back, and we will discuss it Wednesday upon adjournment.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, doesn't have a meeting scheduled, but they're making an unusual request. If anybody has any suggestions for interim topics for that committee, we're always open to hear from some of the rest of you folks.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet Tuesday, tomorrow, at noon recess in House 18. We'll take up Senate File 26, Engrossed Business Entities Registered Agents, if introduced and referred. Senate File 41, Vacating Subdivisions, and Senate File 18, Business Entities Revisions.
Chairman Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet tomorrow afternoon, Tuesday, February the 26th, upon adjournment in Committee Room H-17 to discuss Senate File 25, Engrossed National Guard Life Insurance Contribution Option, Senate File 30, Commercial Vehicle Licensing.
Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet at 8 o'clock Wednesday morning to consider Senate File 28, Investment of State Funds.
Further announcements. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House adjourn until Tuesday, February 26th at 10 a.m.
You have heard the motion. All of those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. All of those opposed say no. We stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, Tuesday the 26th.